issues that came up in recent experiments. So in the first talk, I will, in the first part of the talk, I'll discuss one of the popular modern probes in the field of tronic related systems. This is resonant X-ray. I'll give sort of a brief introduction to it. And I will focus on application of this, probe to high TC cuprates. And I will argue that, in fact, many things which we'll consider puzzling can become much simpler when we sort of abandon the point of view that this probe is just measuring the standard response function, but we really think about the non-equilibrium process which takes place during this resonant X-ray excitation of the system. And then I will switch gears from real solid state systems to talk about what we call now synthetic solid state systems, and I'll talk about interesting demonstration of chiral prethermalized states in non-uniformly split condensates. So I'll talk, tell you about the kind of experimental motivation and our recent theoretical model for what is happening. Okay, so the first part is based on a series of papers. So two of them are published. Another is on the archive, and there's also work in progress. So any comments will be welcome. So, and most of the work was done by David Benjamin, who is a graduate student, but it really started with sort of very productive collaboration with Dima when he was back at Harvard, and then more recently with Israel Klich. And it was quite useful to have the experience coming from mesoscopic physics brought into this field of more kind of strongly correlated systems. Okay, so let me start by telling you about resonant soft X-ray scattering. So this is one of extremely popular experimental probe these days. And the idea is that one sends in a laser. Actually, this is a dozen. One sends in an X-ray at very large energy, which excites electrons from one of the core orbitals to the valence band. And then, so we create a hole in this core orbital, and then this hole is refilled, and emitted photons can be at the same energy or small energy, and then there is momentum transfer. And so basically, this process leaves behind an excitation. So the reason why, what you can say, oh, that looks like a regular X-ray, and we know that this measures density-density correlation function. Well, actually, if you take the usual X-ray, which is called the Hart X-ray, it's really sensitive to mostly ions and core electrons. It actually gives you very tiny contribution from conduction electrons. So it was very difficult to see things that theorists discuss, say charge density wave happening in the conduction band. So the goal of this probe is to actually fine-tune yourself, the probe, to really excite something happening in the conduction band. And as a result, it, kind of the form factor can be enhanced by a factor of 100. So the disadvantage of this probe is finite lifetime of this core holes, but as we'll see, it, it's not such a major issue. But the reason why our experimental colleagues like it is because it's a probe that you can basically apply to any samples. They can be small. It's kind of, it's a bulk probe, and it's apparently a very easy experiment. And one of the first demonstrations of sort of one of the first successful application of this resonance soft X-ray to the cuprates was the observation of the charge density wave. So it was the first kind of X-ray observation of charge density wave in the cuprates. So you can see it corresponds to a period 4. It's fairly sharp. And it basically shows a correlation length of hundreds of angstroms. But what was peculiar, which was observed in experiments, was that this actually, so it's a static, so its elastic peak means that energy transfer was zero, but there was an untrivial dependence on the incoming photon energy, and it shows a two-peak structure, and which are separated by 1.5 electron volts. And so the proposal was, oh, perhaps this is just the Hubbard band. So we see kind of the lower peak comes from the lower Hubbard band, and the upper peak comes from the upper Hubbard band, but in fact, the peak separation is too small for the Hubbard band. So the same probe, if one just studies X-ray absorption spectroscopy, one sees a considerably larger Hubbard gap. So this was a kind of a puzzle. Okay, so let's now think about what is really happening in this experiment. So, okay, we have core electrons and we have a conduction band, and then a photon comes in, right, and we excite an electron from the core orbital to the conduction band. So this is process. Then the state, so the electron goes back to the core orbital, and it's important that the electrons in the core orbitals are immobile, they don't move, they're so well localized. So we have to refill an electron on the same side, okay, and photon flies out. So we can do the usual second order perturbation theory in X-ray, it's called Cramer's Heisenberg formula. So you are looking at the matrix element from the initial state to the final state through this intermediate state with an excited electrons, and obviously you have energy cancellation, and we also have energy denominator. Okay, so now let's talk about elastic scattering. This is the first experiment I showed you. So the final state should be the same as the initial state. And so you see, and then matrix element for annihilating and creating the core electron is obvious, it's trivial, right? It's just one. So essentially, what we measure here, you can see, is really matrix element from the ground state. Now we're just talking about the conduction band. We create an electron, they can overlap with an excited state, and then we annihilate electron on the same site, and then there are energy denominators, which correspond to energies of this excited state. And then we also have to take a Fourier transform, because there was the outgoing photon had a different energy, right? So we saw an elastic peak corresponding to period four. And when you see this formula, this should already be very reminiscent, right? So what we learned from our basic solid state physics that the definition of the local density of states at position r, which is measured in, say, STM tunneling experiments, is precisely this matrix element, right, of tunneling at a given point with all the kind of where the energy difference between the states is just given by the voltage produced by the sample, was energy in the density of states. But there is one, actually, there are two important differences between resonant X-ray and this simple formula. This is that when we talk about the energy of intermediate state, this should really be energy computed with the core hole potential, right? It's not just adding electron to the conduction band, it's also adding a core, which provides some scattering. And also, we have a finite lifetime of the hole. So, but nevertheless, let's close our eyes and say, well, okay, let's disregard the finite lifetime. Let's disregard the fact that there is a core hole potential. And okay, there is another difference that, you know, in this case, so STM can either add an electron or remove an electron, right? In this case, we're always just adding an electron, right? We're moving electron from the core orbital to the conduction band. So this term is not there. But otherwise, it's just part of the Green's function, which, as we said, is measured by STM. And one can work out, basically find a simple, right? So this mentioned part of the Green function, as we said, what's measured in STM. And we just have to take the part of STM, which corresponds to, let's say, energy convention, basically, let's say, injecting an electron. So we need to take the electron part of the Green function, which corresponds to a certain sign of voltage, like negative voltage. And of course, as you know, there has been a lot of study of high-TC cuprates using STM, so the band structure parameters, the quasi-particle dispersion has been well determined. And so if we use this relation, we basically find that the, this resonance of the X-ray should be related to STM spectra as simply integral over the energy, which again is not so surprising, right? Remember that basically, as we said, in the density of states, right, which we have delta function. This is what STM measures, whereas what measures X-ray is basically, this is energy denominators coming from perturbation theory, so we just have to, you know, integrate these delta functions to get resonant X-ray. Okay, and then we take a simple model, like basically mean field model of superconductivity, canonical parameters of either from ARPES, density functional theory, And we calculate the curve. And it actually, you can see that it has, so this kind of purple dots experiment, this blue line is the theory. So the good news is that we actually see two peaks at the right positions. And the bad news is that they have very different height.
Can I just ask, what happens if you do this for a simple case? Just a metal or...
This is a metal, basically. Actually, you'll see that it doesn't matter whether it's superconductor or not. We're talking about peaks. Just you'll see that actually what, if you ask what are the states that really contribute to this peak. So somehow you have to look at quasi-particles, which are very strongly scattered by this period four potential, right? And actually, if you just take the band structure of the cuprates and you ask, okay, to be affected by period four potential, we have to draw the Bragg planes, right? We basically write planes which are separated by plus minus the wave vector so that we're looking at degenerate points. And you can immediately see that there are two types of excitation, two types of quasi-particles. So there's one kind of family of quasi-particles which are very close to the Fermi surface. And you can see that this is the line where these kind of Bragg planes are parallel to the lines of constant energy. And so this gives us a very large density of states. And this is basically insensitive to the fact that we have D-wave superconductor. Then there is another part which comes from very high energy part of the band structure, but it's still basically it's dynamically nested from the surface. So this is just lines of constant energy which can be connected by this ordering wave vector to pi over 4. And so because of this nesting character, we get a large density of states. And in fact, separation between these two types of quasi-particle, just from the band structure, we didn't do any fitting just to canonical band structure. You know? And for cuprates, it's precisely the separation between the peaks as measured in experiments. But obviously, we have to understand why do we have such different height. So Fabian, did I answer your question? So at this point, I'm really taking point of view non-interacting quasi-particle. I took them to be BCS, but it would not change the answer so much. Oh, no, so, okay, the lower line, that's just the Fermi surface. And then the second line is we basically went over lines of constant energy. And so we find constant, it's kind of, it's dynamical nesting. So it's not nesting on the Fermi surface. It's nesting at finite energy. So we find energies at which you have dynamic nesting for, which corresponds to period four.
And you don't show that when I was looking at the Fermi surface?
Sorry?
We don't see that second peak in momentum space because you're only taking a Fermi surface cut.
In this case, you see the momentum of the probe is a momentum transfer.
No, I know. So where is the second peak?
So in experiment, this is there is a first peak and then there is a second peak at this guy.
But where's the momentum transfer?
So in both cases, oh sorry, I guess I should say so. This is period. This is 2π/4, and this is the same thing but with Bragg reflection. So there is like this is the wave vector which connects the two red lines. It's 2π/4 plus 2π. It's red to red. That's correct. Yes. So I sort of, sorry, I sort of, I should have mentioned that, yes, there is kind of addition of reciprocal lattice factor. Good.
Otherwise, the calculation doesn't know about the stripes in LBCO.
About what?
About the stripes in LBCO. You're just assuming that
it's mean field. I just take something, you know, the simplest time of, you know, period four structure. Sure, because otherwise I have to have a process which does not conserve momentum. But in fact, actually, I did not even bother writing the BCS part of the wave function. Yeah. So what is so here? It's really because the picture is that we have, let's say, if it's a weak charge density wave, you have quasi particles, which is basically without charge density wave, but then they can be resonantly scattered by this period four structure from between this nested Fermi surfaces, lines. It turns out that you have to do more work than that. So, okay, that's actually where Dima's insight came in. And basically, the idea is the following. So let's, so we have an initial state. We put an electron in the conduction band, and then we have to propagate it with a potential, but this, sorry, with a Hamiltonian, but this is no longer just a Hamiltonian of sort of okay, we took it non-attracting quasi-particles, it also has a core level potential, right? And then we have to look at the matrix element of annihilating electron on the same side. And Well, it's somewhat complicated because clearly once we make a core level, then our state is not an eigenstate. Our initial state is not an eigenstate of this new Hamiltonian with a core hole potential. But what makes it simple is that we actually start with a slated determinant state. And even though the slated determinant state evolves in a time-dependent potential, it stays a slated determinant state, right? So that's the essence of segnality catastrophe. That's why we can calculate it. But basically, we simply have to understand how single particle eigenstates evolve in this time-dependent potential and then combine them back into the slated determinant. And so that's what we will do now. So basically, okay, the technical problems that we have to solve is initial state. Okay, so that's, okay, it's an eigenstate of I0, so this doesn't matter. Create an electron, but then evolve with the potential, which has an extra powerful kind of attractive potential. So now you can see where dynamics comes in. It's really non-equilibrium dynamical process, which is sort of similar to orthogonality catastrophe. Okay, so let's see. As I said, the essence of so what makes it possible to do such calculation is a functional determinant formalism, which really translates this evolution from the Fock space, from the many-body space, to a space of individual eigenstates. And you can, okay, so let me just give you the general structure of the answer, then I'll show you how it really arises. So first of all, you see determinants. So this determinant, this is basically orthogonality catastrophe. Once we have a core hole potential, it's not only, we're not only asking about the dynamics of the extra electrons, which we injected on site M, but also now the entire Fermi C will be affected. And this is really captured by this determinants, and on these occupied states evolve, and it's squared because we have two spins, so each of them gives its own determinant. And this part basically is the dynamics of an excited electron. So let me give you at least a flavor of how these expressions can be derived. So generally, let's say we have expressions. Let me start with even simpler expressions. So we have to calculate some expectation value of a quadratic operator in the Fock space, right? We really have to sum over many body eigenstates, and then maybe, you know, this with the weight given just by the usual Gibbs ensemble. And okay, so the way to calculate it is to choose a basis in which this operator x, right, is diagonal. And then you can write the trace of x, so we can go to the eigenstates. Once we write it in terms of eigenstates, then basically we know that so once we can write operator in terms of the occupation number and the energy, we simply have to sum over occupation numbers being 0 and 1 in this eigenstate basis. So when we sum, we just get a product of this 1 plus exponent, and then we can we immediately see that we can write it as a determinant of the operator, but notice that this is now operator x taking in the kind of in the single particle space rather than the Fock space. And you can, let's say, even if your operator is somewhat complicated, it's a product of two quadratic operators again. So you can actually, by Baker Campbell-Hausdorff, you can write it as just one exponential quadratic operator, go through the same argument, and again, write it as a determinant. And then finally, if we have insertions, when we, it's not just the operators that we have to calculate, but we also, let's say, annihilate or create an electron, then we have to put in kind of resolutions of identity, just the full basis of eigenstates. Okay, it's fairly trivial algebra, so let me not go through this, but you can immediately check that, again, by going to a kind of eigenstate basis of this operator Z, we can convert this trace taken in the many-body space of slated determinants into a determinant taken in the single particle basis, now with extra matrix element coming from this creation and annihilation operators. Okay, and so this is what happens. So remember, we had these two peaks which did not agree with experiments. Now we introduce an attractive potential of the order, I forgot, the order of basically electron volt. And this immediately, so it keeps the position of the peaks, which was determined by the band structures, but it shifts the weight of the peak to low energy. And it's a very simple effect. It's basically a statement that when we move an electron from the core orbital to the conduction band, there is attractive potential from the core orbital. So it's kind of excitonic effect, which is well known from orthogonality catastrophe, which pulls a lot of weight into the bottom of the spectrum and takes it away from the upper part of the spectrum. And so now, in fact, this is a fairly so this kind of core hole potential is fairly reasonable. You will see that later on we can use it to explain other data as well. And so essentially, that was the only fitting parameter which allows us to understand to understand this resonant X-ray. So this 2P structure, therefore, it has nothing to do with the kind of upper Hubbard band, but it really is just a band structure effect. It also shows that. So I took a model of non-interacting quasi particles, and you can say, oh, they have to have a finite lifetime, but at least this finite lifetime has to be longer than the lifetime of the core hole, which we also put in. Okay, I didn't say this, but you can put in a finite lifetime of the hole into this memory function formalism. So therefore, it actually, it's not, okay, it shows us that this quasi particle description is actually surprisingly good, even when we talk about quasi particles created 1.5 electron volt above the Fermi surface. Their lifetime seems reasonably long, of the order of, let's say, 100, at least longer than inverse of 150 milli electron volt. Interestingly, this very long lifetime of electron type quasi particles was also observed in MFT by Don George and collaborators. Yeah?
Is there some sharp effect associated with the sharpness of the quasi particles, or it's just for the fit work?
There's no fit. There's no fit. All we say is that we did not have to introduce finite lifetime of quasi particles. If the lifetime was shorter than the lifetime, that would broaden the peaks even more.
Anyways, the peaks are not charged; they're brought to.
That's right. So that's why I cannot say that you know the lifetime is you know infinite. I can just say, look, the lifetime at least has to be longer than the lifetime of the core hole, which corresponds to the inverse of the lifetime of core holes is 150 MeV. But it's surprising because we talk about you know 1.5 EV electrons. So, okay, other questions. Good. Okay, now let's move on to the other kind of set of puzzles that was in the context of resonant X-ray. Now we talk about inelastic X-ray. So previously, right, it was basically ground-to-ground state transition. Now we this is kind of it's this probe leaves behind an excitation, and there is momentum transfer, there is frequency transfer, and what people observed is that they can take very strongly doped materials, essentially overdoped, and it's in a very general effect. And they still see dispersive peaks, which are fairly strong, and in this resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. And so they started discussing them as magnons, right? Because if you see a reasonably sharp peak, it disperses, why not call it a magnon? But what is very surprising is that actually, in the same energy window, neutron scattering does not see strong magnetic scattering. Right. So how, and kind of, because I tend to believe neutron scattering is a kind of more conventional, more robust probe of spin excitations than resonant X-ray. And also, we kind of know that when we talk about overdoped cuprate, they are already metals. Right? So somehow TC is down. If it's of magnetic origin, probably magnetic fluctuations have to be weaker. So there are many reasons to suspect that okay, somehow seeing the strong magnetic peaks is somehow suspicious. And in fact, these peaks, okay, as you mentioned later on, somehow the intensity does not change. They go very smoothly into peaks, into an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. And perhaps that was one of the reasons why people started saying, oh, this must be a magnon peak. Okay, but now let's... try to understand this resonant inelastic X-ray. And again, taking a quasi-particle picture, after all, there have been, you know, let's say, quantum oscillations observed in cuprate. So we know that the starting point of a metal is not so bad, especially if we're talking about overdoped, close to optimal doping. So this is the probe that we're discussing now. So we, again, take a core electron, move it into the conduction band. But now this state is refueled by one of the electrons at low energy so that the system leaves behind a particle hole excitation. So also what was done in this experiment when people tried to look for to understand whether it's magnet peak or not magnet peak, they changed polarization of photons in order to make it a kind of a spin flip or non-spin flip process. Just, you know, as usually we are talking about, kind of hoping to turn it into a spin response function rather than a charge response function. So the formalism is fairly similar, except in this case, again, we just, so we have to calculate now. Now, when we talk about going from here to there, it's just the matrix element, right? The amplitude. So we have to start from the initial state, create electron in the conduction band, evolve with the energy, which also has a quark hole potential. Then we annihilate an electron on the same side and fill the quark hole. But that's only the amplitude. So to calculate the intensity, we'll have to take the square. And then if there is momentum transfer, it's just we have to sum, you know, do the Fourier transform in space. So we can go through the same. What is also important here is that actually, okay, even though the conduction band, there is very little spin orbit coupling, but there is a fairly appreciable spin orbit coupling in the core orbitals.
But the core, there's 1s on the oxygen, is that right?
I believe it's p orbital of oxygen.
That's pretty funny. So it's got that bigger spin orbit?
Yeah. Okay, and so we can again turn this intensity. Its intensity, it's like the square of the amplitude, and we can again try to write, you know, this process. So I gave it to you basically in Fourier space. We just write it as some evolution operator, and you can see that it now sort of it looks sort of like propagation in the Hilbert space, forward and backward. That's just because intensity is amplitude times amplitude conjugate, and each of the amplitude itself, as we saw before, has creation annihilation. And now we also have to do it backward. And evolution also involves now this kind of quark hole potential created on different sites. Anyway, but one can do all this kind of the same formalism, functional determinant formalism, and look. And again, we don't do any fitting of the band structure. We just take, you know, canonical band structure. And we tried it for the Stalling materials, for disco materials. And you can see that we actually get essentially the same peaks as was observed in experiments. So the Fermi surface is sufficiently nested that even response function, again, it's not, okay, I'll show you later that it's not really a Linhart function, but it kind of has a flavor of the Linhart function. You're not surprised that when a Linhart function has something like near nesting, as we know for the cuprates, it can have peaks. So, and you see the peaks, and they give us dispersion. And as I said, we get the correct dispersion even without fitting the band structure, just taking the canonical band structure parameters. But here is an argument which originally convinced people that actually this is a collective mode rather than just, you know, particle hole excitation. They said, oh, you know, if this is just a model of non-interacting electrons, if this is just a Linhart function, basically spin flip and non-spin flip sectors have to be the same. You should get the same peaks. Whereas in experiments, you can see that they are different. Well, actually, it turns out that, again, yes, if you think about it as a Linhart function, they would be the same. But once you really think about it as this non-equilibrium process, when you kind of a perturbed Fermi C has to evolve in the presence of the quark hole potential, response and the spin and charge will be very different. And the physics is that once you promoted an electron from the core orbital to the valence band, remember, we previously talked about excitonic effect, electron with the spin, which corresponds to the spin of the quark hole, is kind of bound to this quark hole. And it's very difficult to dislodge it. And it also provides Pauli blocking, right? So therefore, electrons with the same spin actually cannot fill in the quark hole. So you have to give extra energy to the system in order to actually push this electron, which you put from the core orbital to the valence band to away from this site, away from this bound state. And whereas if it's a non-spin flip process, if it's a spin flip process, then electrons with a different spin can easily fill in this core state. And that is precisely shows why in the kind of charge spec, charge sector, sort of without the spin flip, the spectrum is kind of suppressed at low energies and pushed to high energies. So in this case, again, the only okay, kind of a fitting parameter was the potential of the core hole, which is again the same electron volt as we have seen before. It gives you, otherwise, there are no fitting parameters, and it gives us a reasonable description of the data. Yes?
X-ray scattering is a little bit different to what people have looked at before when they tried to analyze this Wix data, if I understand correctly. And so they did these measurements also on the 1D chain coup rates. Yeah, and in particular, what they saw there, the kinematics of the data follows beautifully just the spin excitations, for example. Yeah, and is that compatible with your viewpoint?
At this point, I develop a theory for a metal. If you talk about spin chains, that's probably not a metal.
No, it's the charge sector's gap, but nevertheless, I mean,
okay, what's different? Typically, you know, that's the kind of analysis that people have been done for Cooper. They would say, oh, either they would claim, oh, it's the same as, you know, just spin response function. Or they would try to do some kind of cluster calculations on a finite, like, I don't know, 2x2 or 3x3, and try to compare to experimental data. So I believe that, okay, I try to argue that actually you cannot think about it as a response function. Actually, I'll show you in just a second why it's not. Okay. Yeah, so there is a falsifiable prediction of the difference between just calculating spin response function and doing this. Because if it's spin response function, it only depends on energy transfer, but not the incoming energy of the photon. Actually, if you calculate it in this case, so here, so there is like some incoming energy at which you have the largest signal, but then if you change this energy, the peaks get shifted. So it's for different incoming photon energy as a function of energy transfer, the curves change. And the reason for this is actually it's really dynamical, so that your incoming photon energy tells you at which energy you throw in an electron. So it's going to give you the phase space available for your scattering, and that's why it matters. So in something like kind of, okay, say dispersion, let's say the peaks do not change so much, like if you look at delta omega and Q, but except for this, let's say, in this case, we can see that there's a difference between charge and spin sector, which, okay, you wouldn't suspect from non-interacting electrons. Well, in fact, frankly speaking, okay, it's prediction anyway, there is already some experimental evidence that this has been seen in cuprates. So yes, but actually so far we kind of, it's, as you can imagine, it's a, wow, okay. So it's somewhat cumbersome even for, so it's, you know, even for cuprates, it took us some, you know, just technology calculating all of these determinants, okay, takes some work. But frankly, the biggest puzzle, and I think that is something that one needs to understand before talking, start generalizing to other states, is these peaks, right, which we can understand very well. They seem so natural from the point of view of quasi-particle metallic theory. Interestingly, they go very smoothly into the mode insulating phase, where you know that this model of non-interacting quasi-particles doesn't work. So I think that is actually an interesting challenge. So far, okay, we analyzed this as a non-equilibrium problem, but it was kind of a very simple kind. It was just non-equilibrium dynamics of slated determinants in some time-dependent potential. If we talk about going to the insulating state with magnetic excitation, then it will be a non-equilibrium dynamics of really some complicated many-body state, different degrees of freedom. But I think it's actually a very interesting new direction for non-equilibrium dynamics, understanding this resonant X-ray experiments.
So the insulator half-filling, or?
They basically have them all the way from half-filling to, you know, overdoped.
So in the half-filling case, they have to insert the electron at the upper Hubbard band, right? So no choice. So how can it work smoothly? It basically, at some point, has to go to the upper
That is a question. So I have not seen the data analyzed very carefully from the point of view of incoming energy. So, but from the point of view of, let's say, delta, again, nobody has done this extensive study. They would show you, you know, like two or three points, because there are so many parameters. There is incoming omega, there is delta omega, there is delta q. They would just show it as a function of delta omega and delta q and say, oh, look, I go from, you know, anti-ferromagnetic insulating state to overdoped. And it kind of looks the same. There are like tiny changes here and there. So it must be the same beast. But I think that actually for overdoped regime, this quasi-particle picture makes a lot of sense. So somehow we should, like, okay, one needs to reconcile these two limits.
But also in the anti-ferromagnet the upper Hubbard band, you can imagine it's a good quasi-particle.
That's right. And nobody has done this analysis. All analysis in the antiferromagnetic state was based purely on the Heisenberg type model. That when you basically so that's a theory of underbring, that if you create a core hole electron, you change the local super exchange, and then you ask how does it affect the Heisenberg model. But so clearly we have a different perspective. Like, so we know how to understand magnetic insulating state, know how to understand the kind of metallic phase, but what's in between is an interesting question. Okay. Okay, now let me change gears. So Dima, how much time do I have? Okay. Now let me change, as I said, from systems that we kind of arise naturally to systems which, as we said, I engineered in the lab. But as you'll see, again, questions of non-equilibrium dynamics are very interesting here. So many of you already know that some time there have been very interesting non-equilibrium experiments coming from Jörg Schmidmeier's group in Vienna, which are based on understanding sort of dynamics of split 1D condensates. So, okay, I'll try to be brief since many of you are probably familiar with the technology. So they start by preparing one-dimensional condensate. And then, okay, let's look from, so this kind of view from below, right? But then if we look from the side, kind of going this way, so they basically, so there is first one trap, right? So which gives you just one condensate, but then they can sort of change the confining potential from a single minimum to two minimum, effectively splitting one condensate, which was here, to two condensates, which were sitting in the two wells. And then what they do, then after they split, they let the phase evolve, they get interference fringes, and then they can analyze a distribution function of equilibrium fringes. They get full distribution functions. And one of the arguments that they made was that actually if they split their condensates, then effectively the system thermalizes, so one can actually get a very good description of the kind of these full distribution functions, like for different length scales, using just one temperature. And so again, let's say, okay, that's just an example for, let's say, what the distribution functions look like. So this is really just, you measure interference fringes, you measure like shot-to-shot fluctuations, you get distribution function. And then you compare, and okay, the small deviation between the thermal state and, you know, the dynamical state, that's really just a result that this is a system has a finite size. And this effective temperature is not real temperature, it's really something that the system inherits from, you know, interactions, just the decoherence of non-equilibrium state is related to interaction. And they show that, yes, this effective temperature depends on interaction. And I don't show here, they check that it does not depend on the initial temperature of the system. So this is this distribution function of the fringe contrast. So, right, you basically, as I said, like you, if you have two condensates, they interfere, right? So the position of fringes corresponds to e to phi of x, where x is a coordinate along the condensate. Then you can integrate, so you have this interference fringes, which is which are out of phase. You integrate from minus l over 2 to l over 2 e to I phi over x dx. It's a quantum operator, right? And this, the phase depends on time. So this is a of t. And so you're looking at long time, and then you're calculating probability of, let's say, a squared, distribution function of a squared. Typically, they also normalize by the system size. Right, and this just shows you that one line is a result of real non-equilibrium dynamics, the other is a kind of a thermal distribution function. This just shows that, yes, this system shows this interesting pre-thermalization. But okay, I mean, if people, I think it's an interesting story. People, I'm skipping the details since hopefully many of you know about it. But what was more recent is that they kind of started looking more carefully at what happens if they start varying the time of the split, right? So this is, again, the split shown in the transverse directions. You have one condensate split into two. And now they started varying the time of the split, because previously the idea was, as long as we do it kind of, it has to be slow so that they don't excite transverse excitations, but it has to be fast enough so that, you know, okay, somehow one could think about this as an instantaneous split. Details do not matter. But then they started analyzing what actually changes if they change the splitting time. And they found something very curious. So, okay, now this, this is no longer a distribution function. This is just two-point correlation function. And basically, you just take, okay, so let's see. So again, think about this as, sorry, here they use z rather than x. So they, it's really the correlation. So you have these two condensates, right? And you measure the relative phase at point z1 and at point z2. And this is this expectation value. Basically, but you try to represent it as a function of both. You don't assume that the system is translationally invariant. Essentially, previously, the assumption was that they could assume that the system is almost translationally invariant. In this case, they really said, let's look at it as a function of two coordinates. And then clearly, if you are taking the same point, right, so this correlation function, when z1 is equal to z2, well, it's just 1, right? And you see a very strong line where basically it's this expectation value is equal to 1 on the diagonal. But what was more surprising, they started seeing this very bizarre cross structure, right? So somehow when z1 is equal to minus z2, there seem to be extra correlation. So that the kind of phase correlation do not depend on just the relative distance between the point, but they really know about the actual position in the condensate. And so this is how it evolves in time. And in fact, this also changes. It depends on how quickly they split. So, well, it's very easy to come up with at least a hand-waving model of why this is so. So now, again, we're talking about only the relative phase. So we're talking about phi equals phi. OK, let me call this right condensate, and this is left. Phi right minus phi left. But it's a function of x. Right, so let's say this is x. And we can think about phase fluctuations, these fluctuations of phi. So we have phi of x. Right, and it can be symmetric or anti-symmetric. Right, we can compare phi of x on phi of minus x. Right, so kind of fluctuation on different sides. And you can very easily guess that the fact that we have extra correlation when x1 and x2 are minus of each other, this simply means that you have different occupation of symmetric and anti-symmetric modes. That somehow in the process of the splitting, you do not excite a kind of symmetric and anti-symmetric mode the same way. And when they just tried it, phenomenology, okay, so never mind this theory. Theory simply means trying to fit this correlation functions, assuming that they have different temperatures for symmetric and anti-symmetric mode. And they saw, in fact, that in order to explain the cross structure, they have to assume this difference in temperatures, which was larger, like which was 60% of the effective temperature. So somehow, you know, the previous argument was that, oh, well, actually, the system kind of pre-thermalizes all the modes have essentially the same temperature. Well, it turns out that the way they have done their previous measurement, they really geared themselves to just measuring symmetric modes. Okay, they didn't realize that there is a difference, so we shouldn't blame them for it. But now they really started looking at it in more detail, and they see this somehow very different population, symmetric and anti-symmetric modes. And as I said, this difference in temperature actually depends on how quickly they split. So if they split sufficiently fast, then this difference in temperature seems to go to zero. Also, okay, previous experiments were more in this regime. And if they try to split slower, they see this very appreciable difference between symmetric and anti-symmetric modes, which shows up in a more pronounced cross structure.
So, how close to being integrable is it? Do you know?
So far, it seems very close because it actually, once it gets into this pre-thermalized state, it's stuck there for a long time. It's a long story. Okay. Why it is integrable. So okay. It's integrable at the Lattinger liquid sense, in a trivial sense, because it's quadratic, but it's also, even after you split, it's still Leibniz, it's still integrable. Yeah. But it's inhomogeneous. Okay, sorry. So somehow what is important here, this cross structure really knows about the finite size of the system, which breaks integrability.
There's one more issue. I mean, so the Hamiltonian is integrable, if you wish, in the Lattinger liquid model, but you also need that the initial state after your protocol is Gaussian.
Well, in principle, because quadratic Hamiltonian, I can evolve from any state.
Otherwise, you can't calculate.
Sure, yeah, that's just a technical difficulty.
Well, but it's an important technique because then you don't know what it looks like.
So it's not integrable in the sense that
it's... No, no.
That's it. I think it's not a matter of principle, just...
No, but what I'm trying to understand is, so if you now have this more complicated way of splitting...
Well, at this point, I didn't try to calculate anything. At this point, this is just experiment. Okay, at this point, I'm just sort of laying you the experimental puzzle.
Is also want to say, so if it's fermented, they want to play with generalized Gibson sample, they need to somehow show there's extensive number of integrals of motion. Because, like in semiconductors.
At this point, they don't claim anything. They don't claim anything. They did an experiment, they see cross like structures, they want to know where it comes from.
There's an interesting equilibrium state, but there's no evidence.
This is a GGE with two temperatures.
Well, actually,
I'm not sure it will. Guys, I'm not sure it's just two temperatures. Look. Don't run ahead of me. So, okay. That's just, I showed you the data. Right now, we want to understand what it is. So, I will not try to analyze it. Okay, you'll see. Okay, actually, it turns out, again, since I don't have time, I don't go into detail. So, when they split the condensate, so previously, the kind of analysis was that, you have a condensate and you kind of cut it in between simultaneously. Well, actually, if you look at how the splitting occurs, they cut coming from the edges, and then this kind of cut goes through the center of toward the center, and so eventually they cut the entire system into two. But it's not really uniform in space; it's really coming from the sides and toward the center. So somehow, if we want to schematically think about it again, some kind of Luttinger liquid. Okay, here, let there is a finite size, and then. So there is this boundary condition, right? You can say that, okay, so previous, let's say here, time t less than zero, we basically had two condensates which were very strongly coupled. But then we start moving this point, so that's where the coupling is switched off. But as you see, it's not switched off uniformly. It's switched off on this kind of trajectory in space-time so that it's always supersonic. Okay, so that is actually the problem that we decided to analyze. So we write the dynamics for the relative phase, and when the two condensates are coupled, you can describe it as a massive, as basically by adding a mass term, which you choose just from the condition that you get the correct correlations right after the splitting. So that's the idea which goes back to Yehud's work. And now we actually take an even simpler model where we assume instead of the more complicated trajectory, we just assume that this kind of cutting knife. When they come in, they simply come in with a constant velocity, but supersonic velocity. We want it to be supersonic so that basically the kind of perturbation from the fact that you cut did not have time to propagate. And also it's the case experimentally. Okay, so now so you can see it's kind of a quench, but it's not just the usual quench in it, or I guess maybe you could call it a ramp. It's kind of space and time dependent ramp, which we want to analyze. Okay, actually, it turned out that it's more convenient to switch to the basis of symmetric and anti-symmetric mode instead of thinking about the, well, again, because we know that we want to see the difference between them. I define a symmetric and anti-symmetric mode so that now I only have to look at half of my system. Obviously, the boundary condition is that for the anti-symmetric, the phase has to be zero at zero. For the symmetric, the derivative has to be zero. And the derivative of the phase has to be zero at the edge. It's sort of basically like condition of the absence of the current. And so clearly this is a model, right? If the mass is equal to zero, right? So it's a model that has conformal invariance, and therefore, we can think about this model as having Lorentz invariance. That's what I really need at this point. So you can see that this kind of trajectory, right, at which what we split, what we basically separate the condensate, they are all connected because it's going supersonically. They are connected by sort of, they separate, have different times in space, but they are space-like, right? Because they are connected by supersonic trajectory. So therefore, there is a frame in which you can actually make this kind of change of the mass instantaneous. So this is a frame which is boosted, and this boost, so it's just a Lorentz transformation now with velocity which is smaller than supersonic velocity. Again, we can go through this in details, but let me just show you schematically. So this is our initial problem. So now we only discuss, like in the lab frame, what's happening between zero and half of the system size. And this is our boundary condition, right, which somehow comes in, right? So here basically the phase fluctuation was gapped. Here it is gapless. And we have kind of, we have fixed boundary conditions and a quench, which is non-uniform in space and time. So this Lorentz transformation turns it into a problem in which now this looks like a conventional quench, right? So we have a jump which is only in time, but the boundary conditions are space and time dependent. Okay, so now what one can very easily do is one can construct eigenstates in, let's say, so we know that before the split we had a massive dynamics, right? So you can construct eigenstates and, okay, let me, so it turns out that there is some subtlety here because, okay, you, okay, let me, since in 5 minutes, let me skip the details. So you can imagine that, okay, this is, you know, it's quadratic Hamiltonian, you can find eigenstates. You just have to find basically states which solve this massive equation, the wave equation with a mass, and then you need to add them up so that you satisfy boundary conditions. And then at sort of after the split, this is now just the usual wave propagation. So this, you know, the usual waves. And again, we just have to combine the kind of the usual plane waves in a way that satisfies the boundary condition. And at this point, actually, at this point, when we satisfied boundary condition at x equal to zero, and then you can very simply rewrite this mode back in the lab frame. And then you can see that, okay, it's perhaps not surprising that, you know, let's say, I mean, because they have to be even and odd, they have a very simple structure, cosine and sine. And then the finite size of the system gives us some quantization on k. So we can actually find, therefore, eigenstates of the system, like, again, in this boosted frame, such that they solve the equation, they satisfy all the boundary conditions, they have quantization of the parameter which takes into account finite size of the system. And then it's basically we have to do the standard Bogolyubov transformation. We know that we start in a vacuum, like of a massive phase, and then we rewrite the operators in the basis of new excitations. And it's somewhat of a complicated Bogolyubov transformation because the system does not have translational invariance, so you are basically mixing all wave vectors. But you know there is a well-developed technology for doing this, so you can really the initial state therefore becomes a squeezed state of the kind of gapless excitations. And okay, once you have modes, once you have initial state, and in this case, yes, it is a Gaussian state because that's because the initial state was a vacuum of another Hamiltonian, and even this boundary condition don't change this, and you actually find precisely the structure that as you change the splitting time, the symmetric and anti-symmetric mode behave differently. And this is really comes from the fact that you kind of clearly symmetric and anti-symmetric mode, because let's say anti-symmetric mode in a sense kind of doesn't even know what's happening in the center. And that's why it kind of less sensitive to this details of the splitting. And you get this cross structure which emerges, and it's a much stronger cross structure if we do a fast split. So, okay, well, actually, maybe this was even more impressive. So you see, like, this was kind of slow split, and this was a faster split, which gives you very strong kind of X cross-like structure, which is precisely what they have seen in experiments.
Right, this 1.5.
Also, this is basically, okay, to begin with, so this, it depends at which time, because this experiment actually shows you this is evolution in time. I'm not showing you evolution in time, because this is, when they started, it was basically just coherently split, right, after the splitting, every point is the same, right? So the relative phase is just locked to be zero, and then it evolves towards the cross structure. Sorry, maybe I should have done the comparison better, but I finished the talk at 2 a.m., so. And you can see that in this case, I don't show you dynamics like computed theoretically. I just show you after the split in order to emphasize how this cross structure appears for different splitting times. Okay, anyway, I think that's a very interesting system. And first of all, both it sort of challenges us to extend our quenches from, you know, kind of spatially uniform homogeneous quenches to something which is not uniform. And in this case, we could use this the Lorentz symmetry of the Lattimore liquid, or generally, yes, we can use conformal symmetry in order to calculate even more exotic non-equilibrium states, and they can be studied in experiments. And I think that's we are seeing one of the first evidence for that. Anyway, with this, I'll finish. I think that, okay, quantum dynamics is not just an academic question. We have experiments both in traditional solid state physics and in synthetic matter, which demonstrate very interesting features of dynamics. Thank you.
To go back to the resonant X-ray, did you try to do some calculations in the underdoped case? And what sort of...
We...
I mean, you showed overdoped and optimally doped. Did you push into the underdoped?
So,
you
yes.
About it, but you didn't show any...
It's a good question. So, frankly, we can take doping to be fairly small and still agrees with experiments. At this point, I'm just getting nervous about using metals to describe experiments. But so far, I would say you can push, sort of, you can see good comparison in theory and experiment up to fairly low doping.
Related to this, cutting the two condensates, when you are separating the condensate, that's a place where the order parameter is very small and a lot of phase fluctuations could be there. So are there roles for some topological effects like
it's one-dimensional system. There are no vortices,
but
right?
Still,
but there are phase. But actually, what we're studying is precisely the dynamics of the phase.
But you have a finite thickness still.
So in the transverse direction, it's basically just a single channel. So the transverse confinement is so strong, there are no transverse excitation. In fact, that's an experiment that they have done, that if they start populating higher transverse bands, all this prethermalization physics disappears very quickly.
So in the split condensate, on the experimental level, so can they actually, in any of the protocols they study to split the condensates, is there any evidence in the data that you end up with a state which is not Gaussian?
No, on the
contrary. Well, the system is not a Lattimore liquid. I mean,
fact,
the question is, okay, you... I mean, we didn't look for it because I think there is no evidence for it, but let's see if there is a good proposal, then I, okay? It's an interesting possibility. I don't know how to generate it.
Yeah, okay.
If I may say something, we're just writing a paper with Jörg Schmidmeier on the question of how close integrability it is, and there are signatures of being away from it in the tomographic approach. We can discuss that. So, it's not quite a large.
I know some of the story. I think they now claim that they do see the end of the prethermalized state and it scales. That yes, you have, if you include this higher band transition. Yeah.
Okay. If you suddenly split your condensates but with a trap, will you see still developing this cross structure, or it's really important that you do it spinally? If you have a sudden quench with a trap.
So far, the cross structure seems to be stronger for faster splitting, but whether you have some kind of continuity.
Imagine that you take Q minus Q pairs, and if there is a preferred spatial directions when you create them, that might be the reason why you.
I mean, you, in this case, I think finite size is important. It's a bit of, okay, I'm sort of hesitant because there are certain issues that I don't want to get into, but we can discuss this. Yes, it's, I'm not sure that, okay.
Last question. What happens if you do the thing in the
subfunding? It's just a more messy problem because then you really have to worry about how, like when you cut, how something like that you, like the cut, excite the system before you. Because so far, what actually made our problem very simple, oops, sorry, the wrong way, was basically this idea that I didn't have to worry about, somehow we only had to solve the problem of, I had to think about it as kind of a, I could convert it into a quench in this boosted frame, right? And that's why this change of, say the mass was like a boundary condition. But if you do it subsonically, okay, it's more messy.
So let's thank you, Jim.